Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the canceled television shows of the horror, sci-fi, and fantasy genre. I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And we are still doing Constantine for everyone who has been tuning in, but if you're joining us, Constantine was a canceled TV series on NBC back in 2014 and 15. And this is our first two-part episode of the TV series that Mr. Seneca has the description for.
This two-part series is called The Saint of Last Resorts. Anne Marie, a member of the Newcastle crew, asks John and Chaz for help in Mexico City, bringing them closer to the heart of the rising darkness. Zed is haunted by her past. Now, this episode was actually aired December 12th, 2014, and it was the mid-season break finale. So then part two, which was the premiere, actually was on January 16th, 2015. John summons a demon into himself to fend off an attack. Chaz, Zed, and Anne-Marie rush to save John.
And it's a demon that we're actually very familiar with in pop culture that we will get to eventually in the podcast talking about it, which I thought was really cool. In fact, a demon who just recently appeared on another TV series involving exorcisms of some kind.
It's a very well-known demon, but we'll get to that soon.
Yes, we will. One thing I'd like to point out is about the episode directors. Episode part two, Romeo Tyrone, has a really great IMDb listing of stuff that he's done. He only did one episode of Constantine, but he did 22 episodes of True Blood, and he was the director. Sorry, he was the director of photography of 22 episodes of True Blood, and he was the director of photography for 60 episodes of Dexter.
Wow.
Yeah, the guy's got it going on, and he directed the episode that we were speaking of, as well as he was the director of photography for this episode, too.
Nice.
Director of photography should direct more, because they can. And the other director, T.J. Scott, as well, his IMDb list is much longer than the previous guy. He has worked on Hemlock Grove, Andromeda, Cleopatra 2525, which is an old show from the creators of Sam Raimi, Xena Warrior Princess, La Femme Nikita, Hercules the Legendary Journey, Kung Fu the Legend Continues, Mutant X, which is a fan favorite show of mine from way back in the day, Spartacus, Orphan Black, Bitten, Bates Motel, The Strain, and has worked on 10 episodes of Gotham, another DC comic show.
Oh man, yeah. They just brought out the A-team for this one.
Oh my god, yeah, these guys are great. They've worked on a lot of great television and some oddball TV like Cleopatra 2525.
Yeah.
So
everyone's got those pieces of their resume that, you know, a bit touchy, but you gotta pay the rent, you know?
Yeah, but they obviously did good enough to stay in Sam Raimi's good graces, because Sam Raimi was the executive producer slash co-creator of Cleopatra 2025, Hercules, Xena, and Spartacus.
Nice.
Hence why Ash vs. the Evil Dead is on Stars.
Awesome. Good show.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Hopefully we'll never have to cover it on this podcast.
Hopefully.
Excuse me. All right. So I have, where do my notes begin? Okay, here we go. I wrote it part one at the top of my notes. So now I have, I'm being smart about my notes because my scribble scrabble all looks the same. So I mark my notes at the very beginning of every episode so I know where to go. It opens at a covenant with nuns who are too hot for movies and TV. Oh, sorry, only nuns in TV and movies are too hot to be real nuns.
Yeah, there's not a single crone amongst them.
No. Even Mother Teresa, the Mother Superior character, is still like, yeah, no.
Yeah, so since we're talking about both episodes, it's just basically one giant episode. Taking place in Mexico City, and, you know, it opens up, and we get the setting of what's going on, and it's basically a postpartum scene in the convent where a baby has been born, and the husband and wife just, you know, happily chit-chatting, and he gives her some candy, and then suddenly the baby, you know, is taken by an entity, and then it goes to, you know, the logo and credits.
Yep, and the mom is dead, which is, kind of sucks, as it just now leaves the dad a single father with a dead wife, which is pretty terrible. Because in the reverse, usually it's always kind of written in television, and I don't can't speak for real life, that women will automatically kind of know what they're doing with the baby, maybe because of nurturing and stuff like that. But when the guys are left alone with the baby, oh boy, are they in? It's a mess.
I mean, comedies have been entirely built on that concept. You know, the whole Mr. Mom movie was entirely just about what happens when a guy takes over the homemaking role.
Yes.
And it takes a while to kind of get into that groove. But with a newborn especially, he can't lactate. So there's that additional challenge to raising a newborn.
Wait a minute, that's
What,
not
you know.
true. In Meet the Fockers, didn't Ben Stiller said he could milk anything, including a man?
Milk a cat? Yeah.
And then not Al Pacino. What,
I
damn
got
it.
nipples. You want to milk me?
Yeah. God damn it. What the hell's the name of that actor?
I can see his
Oh my
face.
God, he's like the Godfather in Bull Run. Cape Fear. What the hell?
De Niro.
De Niro, yeah, it's like, well, I got nipples, Fokker. Can you milk
Yeah.
me?
If you're taking estrogen and whatnot,
Yeah, I don't
yeah,
think it's the
perhaps, but
same. I don't even want it. No, let's not even get into that conversation.
I could talk biology all day.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
We
So
talk
Zed's drawing
farming.
Noah's Ark.
Yeah, so the wife is dead, the baby is missing, the father is actually a cop, very important in the whole plot line here.
We switch to the House of Mystery, where Zed's drawing the Noah's Ark.
Yeah, Noah's Ark. Lots of, Old Testament stuff. All of her ideas about what she's drawing is just basically poo-pooed. Even though it's been proven that what she draws is actually very important to the next case that they're going on, it's being dismissed by John as just being leftover, art school stuff. Touching an angel in the last episode. Gives you a lot of Old Testament, beginning of the world type visions, and that's what she's
Yep.
drawing.
Yep. From our
From our
resident
episode.
angel who guest starred on the show, Megan West, Imogen. I definitely have to say, this is probably up to this point that we've been doing the podcast for the last 7 months, the most religious episode we will get into, probably until like some religious artifact pops up in Friday the 13th when we get to that. But this two-parter is bogged down by Catholicism and nuns and monastery and religion stuff, so it's gonna get deep up in here in the
Actually,
Bible.
let me correct you on that. It's not Catholic mythology that we're actually getting into. We're actually getting into Mesopotamian mythology.
Oh, that's right. That's right. John does say that.
Yeah, so almost everything in this episode, with the exception of Vincente the Tempter, is really all Mesopotamian Babylonian era. So like all of the creatures, all of the myths, even the tool, the Tibetan knife, all of that is non-Christian mythos. So in this episode, while John is kind of posing it as somewhat Christian, like the twisted creature, the imbusce, he poses that as being a creature from the times of Noah. A creature that is so powerful, there's none left. They were all destroyed in the flood. He can't even think about a possibility where they might actually be alive. That creature is not actually a creature in Christian mythology. And I have to tell you, like, I had to watch this the first time, and as I was taking notes, I had to set aside the notes because the episodes were just so good. I was just deeply entrenched in them. Then I watched it again and took some notes. Then I watched it a third time, the two episodes, just to pick up all the things that I missed. And then I dove deep into the depths of comic history and pulled up exactly where they're getting this shit. It surprised the hell out of me that some of this stuff is actually from Swamp Thing Volume 2.
Or is that Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, or still the original creative team?
It was Swamp Thing Volume 2, issues 37 to 50. I didn't take my notes as to who was writing them. Ooh. But that's basically the storyline where the Brujeria actually come into play.
Mm-hmm.
There's a rising darkness with the Brujeria that's in the Swamp Thing storyline. So if you minus out Swamp Thing from that story, and you're substituting in a whole lot of other elements, you're getting this storyline about this rising darkness and the Inbushe, which is actually has been seen in both the Swamp Thing Volume 2 series and the Hellblazer.
Okay, so I was thinking about it, and I wanted to check my facts before I said anything. This storyline that you speak of in Swamp Thing, I have read, because this storyline, starting with Swamp Thing issue number 37, if this is mm-hmm. Volume 2, is the first appearance of John Constantine.
It is.
2 weeks later, Crisis on Infinite Earths number 7 or 2 or something like that would come out, and it's considered like the second first appearance of John Constantine, just based on mm-hmm. the scheduling of when books were released. This issue is the first appearance of John Constantine.
Correct.
And the first appearance of Anne-Marie as well. She makes an appearance in this comic too.
And it's also the first appearance of the Inbushe. It is a really freaky creature. Like, you watch this episode and you can tell, like, the animation is... I mean, it is amazing. You know, the Inbushe walk on three legs, so it's the 2 feet legs and then one hand, and then one of the legs is somewhat of a leg. It's supposed to be connected to their head, and the back is supposed to be twisted, and it's a very twisted looking creature. And the way they animated this, it reminded me of a Tool video. It was great. I loved it. Loved it.
What Tool video?
You know, in the late 90s, they had the animation style. They did it for a number of songs. The animation style with the claymation and then strobe effects on that. I don't know who the animator was, and at this point in my brain, I can't pull up the exact songs. I Will Complicate You. Yeah, that song.
I gotcha.
Yeah. The animation reminded me a lot of that. You know, how the creature moved, and it had no eyes, just the mouth with the teeth, and this creature is actually a creature from Chilean mythology. So it's a legendary monster that protects a warlock's cave and also gets sent out for vengeance or revenge purposes. But these creatures are basically male children that were kidnapped or sold to the warhawk or brujo. And in order to transform them into an Inbushe, a child has their back broken and twisted.
Yikes.
And their form is basically this magic cream gets applied to them, which twists their limbs, and then they're fed black cat's milk and human flesh taken from cemeteries as the way to kind of twist into this creature. It's not really a demon per se. It is just a monster.
Yikes. The Newcastle crew actually makes their kind of first appearance reference in this storyline with the sister Anne-Marie, who, by the way, in the comic book is drawn to look a lot more like the mother from Throw Mama from the Train and the mother from the Goonies.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful actress played by her Claire Vanderboom, an Australian native who is absolutely stunning and has appeared on, like, Hawaii Five-O and several other television shows.
Yeah, the way that Anne-Marie is drawn is definitely a lot different. You know, even when she's a spirit, her lines are drawn a bit softer.
Yes.
But she is definitely an older woman. And in the show, you know, she's quite young. Quite young and attractive, and it seems that they have this relationship, in the Newcastle era.
Yes.
And I don't think John would actually have that type of relationship with her.
In the comic book,
No.
John is definitely a so there's sexist, racist. Is it called ageist? Is that the word I'm looking for? Okay,
ageist,
but
yeah.
they don't have a relationship. They don't have any type of sexual chemistry, unlike they do. Obviously, they hooked up because she was a bad girl, and there's a picture of John when he was in his punk rock days. And also, the characters are much younger in the show. John is supposed to be like in his 40s or 50s in the comic book. And this Anne Marie is obviously in her 60s or 70s. They're just friends. They just happen to work together, and she was a much older woman than John when he was a teenager with this Newcastle crew when they lost that young girl, which all that backstory from the show is explored in, like, Hellblazer number 11 of the comic book series by Vertigo. So John gets the image of the ghost, the psychic appearance of the nun, kind of like the way, like, Charles Xavier or a more closer example to the supernatural, Doctor Strange, in the movie Doctor Strange, Benedict Cumberbatch's film, he does his astral projection, and that's kind of like what she's doing in this.
Yeah, they're calling it bilocation.
Yes.
And, you know, as I had mentioned in an earlier episode, St. Anthony of Padua, you know, the one that has the, you know, the nails of St. Padua, he actually was reported to have bilocated as well, and that was one of his miracles that, you know, got him sainthood. Lots of saints throughout history have actually had this talent, they say. You know, Pope Cyril the Sixth of Alexandria, Padre Pio, St. Severus of Ravenna, just to name a few. No one ever has actually proven that bilocation really exists. Aleister Crowley is reputed to have done it, but done it unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
So he did not know that he was doing it. Someone had said, "Oh, hey, I saw you, blah, blah." And he did not know that he was being seen somewhere else when he was clearly in a different place. In a book called The Discovery of Witches, Matthew Hopkins actually talks about this phenomena in great detail. And it's not a proven thing. No one's really ever been able to forcefully do it like she does several times in the show. But if you are a David Lynch fan, bilocation is one of those things that pops up in the movie Lost Highway. I love that movie. And bilocation is actually one of those things in the movie that the plot kind of heavily drives on.
Anne Marie summons John and asks Zed stays behind to continue getting over what happened with Imogen. And we learn obviously she was part of the Newcastle crew, where put down, like, you know, and John finds out that she's a nun. John turns women into nuns. You know, he's basically he's just that kind of man that after you've been with John Constantine and had your experiences with him, you become a nun.
Or you get eaten by bugs, or you get turned into a electronic representation and lost into a computer.
The other Newcastle crew members are mentioned. Richie's dead, Gary's dead, Judith is dead. Anne Marie still lives, and just to give it, you know, kind of give it away because we'd go through every plot point of the show, she does live through the episode, whereas in the comics, John is the only living member of the Newcastle crew, and I think that carries over into any type of continuity, whether the New 52 rebirth or whatever is going on currently in the Hellblazer comic book.
Yes, although in the show, Richie is still currently alive.
Yes, Richie is still alive. Now,
we just saw him in the first episode, but he's going to be back in another episode.
Now, I call the yum yum moment of the episode that the nuns are so hot in this convent.
That's legit. But I think my yum moment of the episode was Zed tucking in her shirt to be a crop top and posing as a prostitute to get into the prison where John is being held.
Oh, yes, in part two, you mean. Yes, oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes. She definitely tries. She takes her bra off, too.
I just need to see a friend in there and pays off the cop.
Mexican prisons? Are they really that much like Walmart or revolving doors of employees?
I can't say from any sort of personal experience, but I have heard that the Mexican police forces are very corrupt, almost as corrupt as the United States.
Does that also make the boobs look better, a woman taking her bra off? Because I was at a comic book convention for the last 2 days where I witnessed nothing but women taking their bras off while they're still in their costume or whatever, just to help their costume give themselves a lift.
I guess it depends on the shape of your boobs. You know, I can't really go without a bra without it looking kind of weird or being uncomfortable. But, you know, if you've got nice, perky boobs like that does, yeah, hey, go for it, girl. You know, those nipples can cut glass. Yeah, go for it, you know?
I do like when they're at the crime scene investigation, the sister is being somewhat flirtatious, and Anne Marie points to John to, like, cut it the fuck out. Jesus Christ, John, she is married to God.
And he's like, what? She came on to me.
Yeah.
Which was completely true. She totally did.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's all her fault. Shame on you, sister.
In this episode, they also, to kind of figure out where, you know, what happened to the baby and all of that, they use runestones. And runestones, I've used runestones in the past. Runestones, of course, don't have the effect that, you know, Constantine shows them. It's just a divination method. But runestones actually harken back to Norse mythology, and the symbols on them are actually different symbols meaning certain things. In the show, they kind of show them as this, you know, more of a tool than they actually are, but I guess they didn't want to, like, use bones or something. I would think, you know, tossing the bones would have been more appropriate in this type of situation. Mixing Mesopotamian Catholic religious with Norse mythology might be a bit of a stretch, but whatever.
When John and Anne Marie, I think Chaz is with them too, go to the cop's house, they start picking the fruit, and the fruit's actually like human flesh. I thought that was very much like Clive Barker.
Yes. I tried to do some research on where the hell would they have thought of making a pear tree give fruit that was actually fleshy, and the only things that I could come up with were that pears have a fertility element to the wood, to the item, because of course it's shape, and that the placenta being buried is actually a thing. You know, you could bury the placenta and you grow a tree from it. It's a nice little ceremony that a lot of cultures do around the world. But the pear itself has the shape of, like, the amniotic sac. And so I'm thinking that they're pulling the concept, the metaphor of the placenta and the amniotic sac and the baby all into one idea. And then the tree, like, rains blood on them once the pear is pierced. And I'm like, ooh, that's gross and kind of cool, you know?
He makes the Adam and Eve connection and to talking about, like, Lilith,
yeah,
explaining it to the cop about what's going on. And that's cut. And then we go back to the Eddie plot line that was left over from the previous episode. Eddie, the mysterious model who has it out for Zed with his wanting to make a date with her and then sending out his secret texts.
Yeah. And in this episode, Zed touches Eddie and then realizes that, you know, he has this plan to lock her up.
Yes.
And it's very much like the lockup system that was shown in the comics, so that the Resurrection Army and the actual Zed plotline in the Hellblazer comics is kind of merging here a little bit.
Uh-huh.
They're taking away a lot, and they're just putting her in here. And what's kind of interesting is that when Zed is drawing the Imbushe, that particular drawing was taken from the comics, and that was taken from the Swamp Thing Volume 2 issue, and Emma was also drawing the that exact character. So Emma drew it, and so I think Zed is really kind of replacing Emma in this situation. Now, Emma was killed in the comic by the Imbushe, and Emma was also there at Newcastle. So there's a lot of interweaving of plot lines from the comics, from mythology, because Lilith, while Eve's sisters are Lilith, there's also Durgia and Nama. Those aren't the ones that they're actually dealing with here, even though they're claiming that Lamushtu is actually a sister of Eve, but that's not what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of weird. It was a lot to untangle in these two episodes.
Yeah, just because it kind of only lasts in the first episode and then only trickles over into the second episode a little bit. Zed's whole, by the way, plot line is kind of like wrapped up, but it will be continued on later on, whereas like she doesn't want to go back to her father, and she reveals to Chaz, or no, it's Anne Marie later on in the second episode, that those people used her for her powers in obviously a very abusive manner that she never wants to go back to. And I think Anne Marie tries to get her to confide in John at the end of the part two. And that plot line will continue on into the next four episodes of that remain of the TV show. But Eddie is obviously still, was never up to any good. And Zed obviously pulled a fast one on him immediately to get him to confess. And then of course those people showed up with the syringes and stuff to take her back to her father, who's not named. And I don't know who her father is in the comic books. But we won't reveal that until we get to the actual episode that covers more about that, to go into greater detail.
Yeah. And it's not really her father. It's more father as in a title, father.
Correct.
Yeah. And one thing that I thought that she was doing in the episode was she was bringing Eddie back so that he would get trapped in that, like, zero gravity trap that Gary Lester did that one time.
Yep.
But he doesn't get entangled in any traps. And, she uses some of the properties of the vault to really her advantage to overcome the other two captors in certain ways. But none of them actually get trapped in the way that I thought that the house would really defend itself.
Correct. What's funny, though, is while she's, like, trying to get out of there, there's that, like, bottomless doorway pit thing that you just talked about. She is in the House of Mystery. There's so many mystical artifacts. I wish she had just picked one up or whatever. That would have been, like, a great Easter egg to something from the continuity of DC Universe. You know what
as
I mean?
Long
like,
it's not Dr. Fate's mask.
No, it's not Dr. Fate's mask. But if it would be cool if she had picked up like a stick and it ended up being like Zatanna's wand, and that would be kind of cool.
Oh, yeah.
Because I did find out that like Zatanna was supposed to make an appearance in season two. But when we're continuing with the convent plot line, John's not making any situation better. And I think it's Anne Marie who says he'd rather risk your feelings than any other part of you. And I think that's what he's trying to do when he is the way he is towards the other people. And I think that's Chaz saying that to Anne Marie, or Anne Marie saying that to Chaz, because they're old friends too.
Chaz goes way back, maybe not all the way to Newcastle, but they go way back, and Marie has been kind of in the picture before she left after Newcastle, and it kind of freaked her out. But so they're old friends, and they know Constantine well enough to know that his motivations for things, they can seem very selfish. And I think this two-part episode is Anne Marie realizing that while he is selfish in some ways, he has to have that detached sense about him, or else he wouldn't be able to perform his job.
Correct.
And that's a lot like a doctor, you know. You can't get emotionally invested because this person could die.
One of the things I do really like in like a lot of these episodes of Constantine, and man, is it prevalent in this show. I don't know if this was a set or if this was a studio. This was like a studio lot at Warner Brothers, or this was an actual church they went to. But they cranked up the fog machine like crazy when John's performing his little spell outside. And it's just like the fog is like billowing in everywhere, and I love that in any type of horror movie when there's a fog machine or there's like rain or thunder and lightning. I always love it when the fog is a little crazy.
Isn't that like one of those horror movie tropes?
Yes, it
like
is. Just like
the woods shows,
exactly,
yeah.
Just like like the Evil Dead movies or whatever made it really prominent. Let me flip my notes around.
Fog for no reason. Evil is afoot.
Correct.
Okay, so he finds out that the head sister, the nun that is a good friend of Anne Marie, is actually
possessed.
Lamouchten.
Yes. Or possessed? Or she is in disguise.
No, she is. She
okay.
is.
And she, by the way, I don't know what type of content you watch, but I happened to stumble upon for purely research purposes. The type of, like, nun that this nun looks like with the long teeth or whatever reminds me of a series of, like, demonic adult films that were online years ago where the nuns were... Ooh. It was porn, but they were dressed up as nuns, but the nuns had, like, jagged vampire teeth or whatever, but not, like, fangs, but their mouths were just filled with razor-sharp teeth.
Oh. Do you happen to recall the name of these?
No, again, it was purely research for the beginning of Radio of Horror. In fact, I think it was even like, I honestly can't remember, but if you type in like nun adult film or porn, demonic nun, you might come up with like the clip or images.
Awesome.
Yes.
Awesome. I'll have to look that up later.
Yes.
When I'm by
yourself. Anyway. Pazuzu is mentioned.
Yes, but before we get to Pazuzu, because I have some data on that, to go into a little bit of detail as to who is Lamouchten.
Lamouchten, are we saying it correct? Lamouchten?
Lamouchten.
Okay.
That's the actual name. They say it a little bit differently in the show, but that's who they're meaning.
Uh-huh.
Lamouchten is a Mesopotamian demon from the 9th to the 7th century BCE, and she is the most terrible of all female demons. She is the daughter of the sky god An, or Anu, and her basic powers, like, she has, also known as the bearer of seven names. So she can go by a lot of names, and she does a lot of things. But one of the main ideas for this demon is that she kills children and drinks their blood. And she eats men and their flesh, and she steals babies. So, you know, the stealing of the babies in this episode kind of go along with what she does anyway. And she also has some resemblance to Lilith, you know. In the classic depictions of her, she has a lion or bird head, you know, kind of depiction of the lion-ish, you know, has a bit of a mane, beard-ish type of thing. She's kneeling on a donkey. And she's holding a double-headed serpent in each hand.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, this sounds like a Frank Frazetta picture.
Oh, it's freaky as hell.
But it sounds definitely like something Frank Frazetta would have painted back in his day.
I think so, yeah. And then at each breast, you know, she has a dog suckling at her right teat and a pig suckling at her left.
Oh, my.
And her feet are very bird-like.
So this just sounds like one of your typical weekends that you host, huh? For anyone tuning into the Dead TV Podcast, Mr. Zeneca Hope hosts many eccentric, weird, and unusual things that you can find on her website, elegantlykiki.com, for more information about what we're talking about. Thank you very much. Back to the podcast.
Yeah, last Friday I actually sold out the entire club.
Oh, my. Well, we'll have to talk more about that privately off the air.
Okay. The things that she does is part of her powers is that she disturbs sleep. She brings about nightmares. She kills foliage and infests rivers. She bounds the muscles of men, so basically making them weaker. She causes pregnant women to miscarry. She brings disease and sickness, and she kills children.
Oh,
so all these things
lovely.
Are basically like what makes her the most terrible of all the female demons in the Mesopotamian lore.
Mm-hmm.
And then her antagonist, I guess depends on how you look at the situation.
Yep.
Is Pazuzu. Pazuzu is another Mesopotamian myth god from the 8th century to 6th century BCE, and it's primarily invoked to fight against Lamouchten. So,
which none of this, by the way, any of this information about Pazuzu, I don't know if it's actually real in reality, that the reality me, you, and our listeners are listening to, but I don't think any of this was covered in the famous movie called The Exorcist.
The Exorcist, no. Pazuzu is the most famous of all of the Mesopotamian demons, because, you know, it has been used in a lot of pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
The Exorcist movies, it was the demon that was possessing Regan.
Yes.
So,
and it was the, when Father Marin is out on the dig, and he finds the statue of Pazuzu.
Yep. And Pazuzu, it has the body of a man with the head of a lion or dog, so it's very similar to Lamashtu. Talons of an eagle, so he's got that bird, you know, end of the feet.
Correct.
Has a beard or mane type of thing going on. Two big wings behind him, a scorpion's tail, and has the right hand up and the left hand down with an erect penis. And,
oh my.
Yes, yes. You know, hey.
I'm surprised this thing hasn't been used in porn.
I'd have to dig a little deeper on that.
Oh my. There was an Exorcist porno, and it was like pretty spot on. I'm not going to get much more description about it because it gets kind of gross when the pea soup thing happens.
Yeah, but the crucifixion masturbation scene was already kind of pornish, like.
Yeah, but they didn't show it. Remember, that's from her back, so.
Yeah, I know, but.
In the porno, though, she uses like a cross dildo. She like rubber bands two dildos together.
Oh my yeah.
God. Anyway.
The actual depiction of Pazuzu is kind of very similar to the depiction of Baphomet today. You know, has the right hand up, the left hand down. In certain ideas, that could be the right-handed path versus the left-handed path. You know, right-handed path being the path of good and true, and the left-handed path being of evil or selfish. It could also mean as above, so below.
Yep.
So Baphomet is often depicted with the, you know, the goat head and that, you know, the giant wings on the back with the right hand up and the left hand down, where uninformed Christians will call that, oh, that's Satan. Yeah, but those are uninformed Christians, which a lot of Christians are.
Oh, my, yes.
A little judgment for myself.
That's fine.
So Pazuzu was often basically brought about to be the enemy of Lamashtu. So he's invoked particularly to defend against all those things that I mentioned, you know, the blights and the disease and the sickness. But Pazuzu is not a good spirit. I mean,
no.
In the Mesopotamian mythology, demons are actually just spirits. They're not inherently evil. They just do evil things sometimes. And so, Pazuzu is actually the son of the god Hanbi, and he's the king of wind demons, and often depicted as the king of the wind in the southwestern corner. So. He's also a bringer of famine and drought and storms.
Wow. So, he's got a lot going on that is, in most pop culture, it just possession. That's it. That's all he does.
Yeah, pop culture, he's, you know, he just possesses and whatnot. But
I wonder if that maybe has something to do with, like, the budget of films and television that puts Pazuzu in it. That's pretty much all he can do. He shakes a room, but a lot of the stuff you described would cost a lot of money to turn into a...
a
production.
The windstorm and lightning and all these things of his, like, windstorm powers. Yeah, that would be a bit expensive, I guess.
Yeah. Pazuzu returned in the television series The Exorcist, which I'm glad we're not covering yet, because it did get renewed for a second season. For anyone who's not watched yet, if you're a big fan of The Exorcist movie, the first movie, this is a direct sequel to that movie, and I'm not going to spoil anything else other than Pazuzu does appear, but you need to watch the show to get the full explanation how this is a direct sequel to The Exorcist, because everyone loved it and nobody saw it coming.
Nice.
Yes, just watch it. It's on Fox's website or something like that. I'm sure it's being rerun over the summer to get ready for season 2, but watch it, please. I think everyone who's a horror fan would love it, especially if you love Constantine. John kisses the nun before they go off to fight Pazuzu in the sewer, which is kind of, or she kisses him, which is kind of unusual for a nun to do, but obviously her and John have a relationship, so they have that connection, even though she is married to God and she has given up her sexual nature for a life of celibacy to God, you are still a human being.
Yeah.
No matter what.
They've got history, and also she admits that her becoming a nun and going to Mexico was kind of her running away.
Correct, because of what happened to Aster.
Astra. The human elements of this former relationship come up, and she kisses him, and they go and they find the babies crying there in the
sewer
of the catacombs, sewers.
Sewers, whatever you want to call it. I think they're definitely sewers.
Yeah, but why would you have cages in sewers?
Well, because he's a demon. Why do demons do anything? What's really, then of course it really shocks Anna Marie is that John is willing, no price is too high for the, before she just says that John is willing to kill the baby in order to stop the demon. I don't think he would have done it, but.
No, he was bluffing.
Yeah, he was bluffing, but comic book John, maybe.
Maybe. But
no,
I still say even comic book John would have been bluffing.
Correct, because he probably would have had the armies of heaven down upon him for killing a baby.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Manny does make an appearance in the first part of part two, but I think even comic book John would have done this all as a bluff, because it's evident that Lamashtu wanted both babies alive. And so he was using that as a bargaining chip.
The Anne-Marie shoots John, saying that no price is too high because the demon will come after John. John traps the demon within him. But before that happens, I had to write down a note saying, because this was a two-part episode and it does end with John lying in the sewer bleeding out from a gunshot wound, it's like, why does every show do that? Would we know the hero is not gonna die, but they try to build the suspense? But it's so stupid, considering that we know he's not gonna die, but you end it that way. You could have ended it with the possession. That would have been a little better than like, oh no, is John gonna live?
Yeah,
I just
hate
that.
It's television.
I know. I can write television better than that. John burns himself with that thing. What's that thing that he burns himself with?
That's an amulet of Pazuzu.
The amulet. Okay, so that's what makes him jump inside him.
Yes.
And then Manny shows up.
The Imbruche is like encroaching upon him, and he's bleeding out. From the douchebag moment of Anne Marie shooting him, out of everything in that part one, that is totally a douchebag moment. Shooting him so that she could run away and get the baby to safety. He burns himself with the amulet, and as he does so, he is basically terminating all of his protections. So he says, I, John Constantine, terminate all wards and protections. Ego lohas Constantinus termina totum totala, quad precipio solicum capre demonicus. And so that's basically the same phrase in three different languages, that he terminates all his protections so that the demon can go inside of him. Because if you recall, when he was talking with Papa Midnight, he is totally against any sort of, spirit coming into his body whatsoever.
Correct.
And he makes great pains to prevent it.
Now, this must also set off a bunch of bells in heaven, because that's when Manny shows up.
Yeah.
Which proves that Manny is his guardian angel since he was a child.
I guess. I mean, I didn't really think of it like that. I think Manny right now is just being assigned to him at the moment.
No, I really think that, don't forget, as soon as this happens, that's when Manny immediately shows up. Manny had no interest in this case until this happened, because of the fact that he's thinking, well, John, this is pretty easy, and this will allow John to reconcile with this chick that's responsible for the death of that little girl. But as soon as this happens, Manny's immediately there being like, you should have made a deal with heaven. And he's just like, bugger off, Manny, and Manny's no help until later on.
Then he's just fucking useless.
Basically. And then John gets... John's in prison after killing a whole bunch of people, which is fantastic, because we begin the prison arc of the revolving, of like how easy it is to just come in and out of this prison like it's a job. And I love the fact that John... is basically, it's an old thing from like, it's an old prison cliche. You go up to the biggest guy in the yard and knock him out, you become top dog. And that's exactly what happens to John in this episode. He is top dog.
That one moment, you know, he's just slain three of the biggest baddies that rule on the campus there. And he goes, now I run this place.
Yes, exactly. And
oh my god,
that was so awesome, especially considering the fact that he already wiped out the gang on the streets, and now they're the other half of the gang in prison.
Yes.
It invokes like every kind of like prison cliche ever.
Mm-hmm. But it works, you know. In prison, like the strong survive, and so he is, because he just wiped out three people barehanded. Because, of course, he's got a demon living inside him right now. And he is now the biggest baddie on the campus. And, you know, Julio, the person that kind of set up this whole thing, calls him Diablo. And he's like, you really have a devil inside you? And he's like, well, yeah. And then of course, Zed and Chaz use Anne-Marie to bilocate and find John wherever he is, because they lost track of him once he kind of hulked out and pushed Chaz and left. So they find him in the prison and do all these attempts to try to get him the things he needs in order to perform the self-exorcism.
The,
which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, and this is the other kind of yum-yum moment. Zed becomes a nun.
Briefly.
Yeah, she looks pretty hot in that costume. But this whole, by the way, thing with the nuns being like the way they are, being super attractive and the demonic possession, I had messaged Mr. Zeneca while watching the episode about the band Ghost.
Oh, the band Ghosts?
The band Ghost. The girls, the whole band dressed up like priests. And the main Papa, the band leader Papa, dresses up as the Pope, and the girls all dress as sexy nuns.
Yeah.
Like they don't have the bottom part of the dress on. They usually have their like, you know, they're usually their full nun costume, with the exception of the dress is away, and they're in usually just like stilettos and shorts or something.
Mm-hmm. Hot.
Yes, this whole thing reminds me of the band Ghost. That's why.
So I don't know why Chaz actually gets beaten up by the cops to get into the prison. He just kind of walks up to the prison guards and just kind of insults them a little bit and gets beaten up so that he can get taken into the prison where John is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of a stupid way to do it, I guess, but...
Yeah, it's a bit unusual considering that Zed just walked in, you know, flashing her goods and giving him a 20 to do it, which is like, wow, I mean, the Mexican prison system, good job. I'm reminded of an episode of... did you ever watch Family Matters when it was on?
Yes.
There was an episode where Steve, Eddie, and one of their buddies gets... sent to prison in Mexico. At the end of the episode, they finally call their dad, which is like what they should have done to begin with, because Carl Winslow was a cop, and he comes down to bail him out, and he gets sent to prison too. And then of course they find out the bail in Mexico, because he says it's like some number that they can't afford, but then he's like, oh, he translates it to an American dollars and it's $34.
Yeah, because they thought they were confused about the peso translation.
Exactly. So he's just like, it works out to be 34 American dollars. He's like, what? He gets him a 50. So, by the way, is John says Pazuzu is the demon king. Is that correct?
Well, he's kind of the balance point for... he is the king of the wind demons. So I guess he's... a king. I didn't have any record of Pazuzu being the king. So he's the counterpoint to Lamashtu, and he is the son of one of the higher gods, Hanbi, king of the wind demons. It's a stretch, but you know, I wouldn't put it past them just to say that.
You would probably say he's the demon king of pop culture.
Yes. for sure.
Yeah.
He gets the most play out of all the Mesopotamian demons.
I do love the fact that Chaz has an old tape recorder with actual tapes, not an MP3 player, or it's not on his phone, because this is clearly taking place in modern day 2014.
with 50 different exorcism spells that John recorded himself.
Yeah, so exactly.
John doesn't really rely on a lot of super technology.
No, he
if
doesn't.
If you notice, like, he doesn't really even have a cell phone in most episodes.
Once again, while the exorcism is going on, where am I? No, hold on a second.
Well, the first exorcism is interrupted by the tempter.
Correct. Yes,
and the tempter.
Yes, this is when Chaz gets his neck snapped again.
Yeah.
Poor
yeah.
Chad.
He's got the lives he can spare.
Yeah, it just definitely happens a lot. I just remember hearing it going snap. I'm like, well, he's dead. He'll be back in a little while.
Yeah.
I do love the trick of using heroin to get the exorcise the demon, because this reminds me of I want to say it's Scottish horror movie called Boy Eats Girl. Have you ever seen it?
No.
As a zombie fan, I think you need to look it up. Again, I might be that might have the country of origin who created it wrong, but I definitely think it's British in some way, but maybe Australian, but I digress. The zombie outbreak happens. The main male character gets bitten. His mother is an archaeologist. In the beginning of the episode, she is researching like something. She finds like some formula or something to stop probably a zombie outbreak. And she reveals to her son, who she saves his life, that as long as he hasn't consumed human flesh yet, a rattlesnake bite will cure the zombie virus within him.
Interesting.
And I was like, that is interesting. I was like, that's kind of new and clever. I don't know if it's how medically accurate or anything about that, but I don't care. Just something new. And that's what I thought of when they were using the heroin to help exorcise the demon.
Well, I think the heroin was maybe just to pacify the demon enough so that it wouldn't start to take over John's body.
Correct.
Since, you know, it meets Zed and immediately it wants to, you know, sow its wild oats. And John has to, like, by force of will, push it back from, you know, attacking Zed, you know, because she's dressed like a prostitute. So, yeah, sure. Now Vincente... Actually, when he introduces himself, as a Hebrew word. Where is it in my Nahash? Nahash. So he introduces himself as Nahash to I think it's John and crew, and that is actually the Hebrew word for snake. I did some research to try to find out where this character Vincente, or the idea for the tempter, comes from. And in the Bible, you know, there's the snake from the Garden of Eden, which is what this character is supposed to be. In the Bible, it's actually supposed to be an actual snake. Maybe possessed by Satan, who knows. But snake is actually speaking and talking and is a clever creature. Mentioned in the Bible, and so this character is supposed to be a literal snake, which is why he unlocks his jaw and feeds on, who is it, the warden of the prison?
Yes.
Yeah, the warden of the prison is like, oh, I'm, why are you looking at me like that? I'm not looking at you, I'm measuring. And then he unlocks his jaw and goes to feed on the guy. So I think he's supposed to be the literal snake from the Garden of Eden. Not much mythology there to unravel, but it was interesting the way that they did the animation and how after the knife, the furba I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, the Furba knife is actually plunged into the back of Vincente, the tempter, and it just bursts into snakes. Like a video game. It's bursting into snakes, bursting into coins.
I also have to make a correction to something I said earlier in the podcast episode. Issue 37 of Swamp Thing is not the first appearance of John Constantine. That is just happens to be where a lot of the plot lines for this episode come from, such as Anna Marie. John's first appearance was in Swamp Thing number 25.
Oh, really? I have it down here as the first appearance of John.
I've got comiczine.com and DC Wikipedia, DC Wikia from their own website saying otherwise.
Let me reach it behind me at the Saga of the Swamp Thing.
It's issue 25, first appearance of John Constantine, and that's the only first appearance character in there. Issue art also features Jason Blood, aka the Demon, and Abby Cable. Swamp Thing's girlfriend, whatever.
Mate.
Yeah, mate. who does appear, who has not appeared in quite some time in the Swamp Thing, Constantine, Supernatural Forces, but did appear at the end of the Swamp Thing, last Swamp Thing miniseries before DC Rebirth happened. But I digress. By the way, I tried to find out who the Anne Marie summons a naked woman to get everyone's attention when they're trying to get out of the prison after Chaz points out that's the guard I hit who broke his nose. We're never going to be able to get out of here. And there's no IMDb listing for who the naked woman is.
No, that's her. That's her. That's the same person.
Oh, that's Anna Marie?
Yeah, that's Anna Marie.
Oh, I didn't realize it because the entire episode we see her in the nun costume.
Yeah, you don't.
And we don't see her. Definitely don't see her naked except for that appearance. All right.
You definitely don't see her naked, but the first time she bilocates, she's wearing this low cut shirt, so you can see the cross around her neck.
Oh, okay.
And that is actually just her without clothing on, just a pair of panties saying, "Hey, I got robbed. I need some help."
Yeah, okay. All right, I didn't realize that was also her. All right. They go back to the House of Mystery in order to try the exorcism once again.
Which, it's kind of a little surprising for me because they're taking them so far when time is of the essence. Since they're in Mexico and they'd have to cross into the United States in order to do this, and he is a raving maniac at this point in time.
Yeah, he is completely off his gourd with what is happening.
But we're just going to suspend disbelief on that, and that the vault can be anywhere they need it to be.
Yes, exactly. They definitely try to perform the exorcism from The Exorcist without this chant happening. Pause real quick.
The power of Christ that compels you. The power of Christ compels you. That the power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.
All right, so that clip is from the 1973 movie The Exorcist, where the two priests, Father Marin and the young priest, because you need a young priest and an old priest. I always forget the name of the young priest's name.
Young priest and an old priest.
Yes, basically. By the way, the old priest, Max von Sydow, many Star Wars fans, if they caught the beginning of The Force Awakens, may have seen him as the old man who has the location to Luke Skywalker, who Kylo Ren cuts down at the beginning of the movie.
Ooh.
That is Max. Yeah. That is him.
I think the young priest is actually an actor named Jason Miller.
Correct. Yes, you are absolutely correct. But thankfully, we do not get that to happening because otherwise, everyone would just compare it to The Exorcist.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same demon. It's the same.
Never remake The Exorcist, people. By the way.
Now, one thing that as a clarification, the Furbu knife. That's really not how you use it. It is a kind of a demon fighting knife, if you want to say it like that. But you don't stab into the heart with it. You actually pin the demon to the ground through the foot, and then it basically holds it into an earthly position. So then you could exercise it some other way.
Gotcha. Okay.
it's just one of those things that gets used a lot in pop culture, but you don't stab someone through the heart. You're supposed to stab through the foot, or, you know, energetically, it could also be through bowls or rice or something to actually symbolize earthly binding.
Okay.
Yeah. Just another one of those things.
Okay, so I wrote this note down. I think it was from the photo. There's a picture shown of John with Anne Marie when they're in their like Sid Vicious 90s punk phase.
Oh yeah, yeah.
When and they with, said that
mucous membrane.
Correct. And they said that the Newcastle incident happened 20 years ago. The actress who plays Anne Marie, I'm going to look her up right now to see how old she is, because mm-hmm. Anne Marie herself cannot be more than 30 years old, maybe. She doesn't look that old. The actress who played her was born in... It doesn't say. Of course it doesn't say.
You're not supposed to tell the age of a woman.
I don't... Okay, there's no birth date for the actress on IMDb, but she cannot be more than, like, 30-something years old, and they said that the incident happened 20 years ago. When did this... What were they, 10 years old when they sacrificed this poor girl?
It's TV. It's TV.
Oh, yeah, okay.
If you actually had the actors and actresses the right age that they're supposed to be for all the timeline, then they would be in their mid-40s. No one wants to watch people in their mid-40s anymore.
What are you talking about? Most of the Avengers cast members are in their 40s pushing 50. Robert Downey Jr. is in his 40s. Benedict Cumberbatch is in his late 30s.
Their characters are not supposed to be, though.
Oh, yes, of course.
That's the thing.
Downey Jr., though, his character Iron Man, would make sense for him to be in his late 40s, considering how old his father was during World War II when he helped create the Super Soldier Serum. And this relates also to, like, The Dark Knight Rises, when 8 years passed between The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises, but nobody aged.
Nobody aged. And then you're talking about, like, the Suicide Squad, Joker's age, and, you know, we can get into all of that. It's like, ages, don't really matter so much.
Because they're comic book characters?
in pop culture, you kind of have to make some... flexibility with all that, because, you know, people are stupid and they like to see young faces and don't really care about actual timelines.
And they wrap up the episode and free John, and Anne-Marie gives Zed her 2 cents about John once again.
Yep. Yeah, and, you know, kind of wraps it up in a nice, neat bow. Zed is saved. You know, well, she kind of saves herself, you know, from the Resurrection Army.
Yes. Now, there's not a lot of episode reviews for this that I could find online, except for an IMDb posting about somebody thought this episode was wildly diverse from the main story arc since the first episode, because it mainly focused on the prison, and then John's exorcism seemed to take away from what they were trying to do in the first episode. But I kind of disagree with this person, as I felt as though that it was all about this demon, and then the demon just happened to switch bodies from the nun to John.
Well, no. I mean, the nun was a being.
A being,
and
yes.
Then the demon was a different being, and you switched beings that you're following when you go on that mid-season break. So if you watch both episodes back-to-back, it makes sense as a greater arc. But if you're seeing them individually, I can understand how they're saying that, because you're getting the entire resolution of that in part two, but all the setup is in part one.
But they did feel as though that this episode was resembling a issue of Hellblazer from Vertigo as we would get.
The Gary Lester line came straight from the book.
Yes.
You know, the Feast of Friends, like, that was straight from the book. I think because they mixed in a lot of Swamp Thing plot lines in this with the Brujeria, it does feel a lot more like a Hellblazer type of plot line. How this relates to that greater darkness and the Resurrection Army and all of that has yet to be seen, and how these are supposed to be woven in together. But I do feel that this is a very Constantine story.
Yes, yes, absolutely, because Constantine
heavy,
is a exorcism.
Heavy mythos. Exactly. Heavy mythos.
By the way, John has a cigarette once again in his hand. We're always going to point this out because it's a character trait of John Constantine. Did
he
they
actually
ever...
lights it.
Yes.
He lights it.
Yes, yes. Do they, up to the episodes we've seen, they don't mention what brand of cigarette this is, right?
Correct. I think they might have shown it in the distance, but it was not really recognizable.
So
in the comic books, he smokes Silk Cut.
Yes, which is a brand of Japanese cigarettes, mm-hmm. imported to France, it seems, based on the from what I've read about it. I'm not a cigarette expert, and I'm not going to try to be because I don't smoke, and I don't want to smoke, and neither should you. Learn a lesson from John Constantine. Don't be smoking. You know what would be great if John was, like, in one of those anti-smoking commercials, and he, like, picks the cigarette, he's like, nah, it flicks it out, and it's like, don't smoke, or, you know, whatever the slogan is. That would have been great.
Didn't they try to do that with the Constantine movie, with Keanu Reeves taking a stick of gum instead of grabbing the cigarette?
At the very end, yes.
At the very end, yeah.
Yeah, because like, he beat cancer.
He beats cancer pretty much, and then pops a stick of gum instead of what he actually does, is he goes and smokes a goddamn cigarette.
Yes, yes. And if you want to learn more about the Constantine movie, you can go over to the Radio Horror YouTube page where Mistress Zeneca and I have a Constantine commentary up for Film Dungeon commentary based on that film.
I got a little drunk in that.
You got what?
I got a little drunk in that.
Yes, I could absolutely tell. not one of Keanu Reeves' better films. You want Keanu Reeves' better films? Go buy John Wick 1 and 2.
It was fun, though. Yeah, this episode, he actually does put it in the cigarette in his mouth, and he lights it. And at that point in time, it's when John is so frustrated with potentially having this creature that he thought that there's no way possible that the Imbushe could actually, you know, be in this world. And he's just so flustered and overwhelmed by the impossibility of the situation. And I think that's how they can justify him actually lighting that cigarette.
By the way, if you were in absolute love with the actress who played Anne-Marie, Claire Van Derboom, you can go watch a movie she was in called The Man Who Got Away, where she's wearing a fishnet tank top and black bra.
Ew.
And she's on Masters of Sex, but that's only if you're really interested in that sort of thing. Which, by the way, I got to point out, all the great female comic book characters have been on Masters of Sex, including the actress who plays Supergirl on Supergirl. The TV show was in an episode of Masters of Sex completely nude.
Completely nude.
So she went from Glee to Masters of Sex to be like, I'm done with Glee, I'm over 18, to now being the Girl of Steel. Somebody sent me that link the other day because they knew I was a Supergirl fan. I was like, did you know she was on Masters of Sex? And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Now I need to watch that show.
So one of the things that I thought also very interesting about this is in the comic books, the way John gets demon blood in his system is Nurgle gives him the demon blood, puts it into his IV or whatnot to heal him, you know, so he can do Nurgle's bidding on something. In the show, he has this Pazuzu demon possession, and yet in the storyline for Zed in the comic books, she gets kind of taken out from her situation by having sex with John because he has demon blood, and that taints her, so she is ineligible to have this coupling with an angel, and then, you know, that whole plot line falls apart. I find it interesting that if they were going to do that, this is the way that they're getting this demon crossover with John's DNA. And I thought that was kind of interesting, and how they play it is as something I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, with only 4 episodes left, I don't know where they would have gone with that,
and I
don't remember how the series, the unfortunate series finale ended. I don't remember if it was a cliffhanger or not, only because obviously over John jumps ship from NBC to CW for an episode of Arrow, and he's just, when Oliver calls him, he's just kind of rolling down the streets of London. which was the most studio backlot looking London setting ever. just obviously for a quick, like, before you come out, like, you know, it was like, okay, we're going to shoot this in the backlot of Vancouver, where we shoot Arrow on this, on the Warner Brothers lot, and then you're going to jump into the warehouse for the actual, the ritual that you're going to help perform with Oliver and company.
But we'll
get there. It's just kind of, I don't remember how the rest of these episodes go, because I think it was this two-part episode is actually when I stopped watching the show, because I'd heard it was not being renewed, and I said to myself, oh, I'll wait until it's on DVD and then rewatch the whole thing from the beginning. So going forward, the next several episodes I have never seen before, so this will be a great new experience for the both of us. You haven't watched past this episode, have you?
No, I try to stay on the episodes that we're doing so that I'm kind of surprised when things work out or they don't work out. I know certain things happening, like in the next episode, Quid Pro Quo, we're going to learn a lot more about Chaz.
Yes.
But that's only from my research on Constantine do I know that. I haven't actually watched the episodes, and I like to be able to look forward to every time we do these, something new that I find or how that ties in with the episodes past, instead of just power watching the whole thing and then knowing the end of the storyline and how that relates to the point that we are now.
Correct. And I think the next episode is actually based on a self-contained graphic novel of Constantine where Chaz needs John's help in order to help his daughter.
Yes.
Yes. And then we have another episode later on, which I think Jim Corrigan returns. But one thing I definitely remember about this episode, Mr. Zeneca, and do yourself a little bit of research. Look up the character Felix Faust, a longtime DC villain, makes his appearance in this episode.
Okay.
He is a well-known usual antagonist of supernatural beings such as John Constantine, Zatanna, and Wonder Woman. In fact, if you can find it, I think you can find it on like Warner Bros. Website. You may be able to find it on YouTube, but however you can, there's the two-part episode of Justice League, the animated series, in which Felix Faust turns the entire island of Themyscira to stone, and Wonder Woman needs the help of the Justice League to free her mother and all of her sisters, as well as stop Felix Faust, who is trying to... I think he is trying to make a deal with Ares to bring Ares back to Earth.
Okay.
And it's fantastic. It is a great episode, because also Diana's got this great line, because they don't do the whole origin where she does like the trial by combat. She doesn't bring Steve Trevor back to the island. They changed Wonder Woman's origin around a bit for this, without going into a backstory, because we kind of already knew her backstory. She's on her way to Themyscira in the invisible jet, and she's like, well, what do you mean, mother? I've been on the island the whole time. Oh yes, that will work out so well. I've been hanging out with other superheroes. No, she'll never buy that either. So she kind of left the island with the whole Wonder Woman getup or whatever without telling her mom. But Felix Faust is, I think, voiced by Mark Hamill in these two-part episodes of Justice League, the animated series.
Interesting.
And he was also in Justice League Action, which is a show that John Constantine shows up in, played by John Cryer from Two and a Half Men.
Interesting.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm going to correct myself. Robert Englund played Felix Faust in the Justice League animated series.
Ooh, yes. Even better.
Paradise Lost Part 1 and 2, and then The Balance all starred Robert Englund.
Nice. Okay.
Yes.
Cool. Yeah. I'm actually on the Hellblazer comics up to issue 123.
Wow. You have a long way to go before issue 300.
But I've got all the trade paperbacks, so I'm just kind of going through them little by little, so that by the time this series is done, I would have gone through the majority of them.
And then you could write an entire dissertation on Constantine.
What do you think this podcast is?
Oh, yes, exactly. We should totally get graded for this. And you can grade us if you go to iTunes, leave a comment, leave a rating. You can also comment on our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter. My Twitter, the Facebook page is The Dead TV Podcast. My Twitter is @ChrisDSAV. Mr. Zeneca's is?
at Elegantly Kinky. So find me on my website at elegantlykinky.com.
And the rest of our episodes you can find on radiohorror.com, as well as the four aforementioned iTunes, or on Google Play if you do not happen to have an iTunes account or an iPhone or an iDevice of any kind. Sorry, Apple device of any kind. And the comic books we referenced, you can pick up the Volume 1 and 2 of the Alan Moore Swamp Thing. It's called The Saga of the Swamp Thing. Go to your local comic store. Just ask them for that, as well as the Hellblazer comic books. They're all usually still in print, and most comic book stores will be carrying them for you to make for you to read up on the world of Hellblazer.
And they do stand the test of time, I have to say that.
Yes, they do. They are all extremely well written. If you want the more modern day ones, you can pick up like Justice League Dark or the Hellblazer Rebirth Volume 1, which came out just a few months ago, and Volume 2 will actually be out next month. So stay up to date with all of what's going on in the DC Universe that way. And thank you once again, Mr. Zeneca, for joining me for this two-part episode of Constantine.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me once again.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more Constantine with the episode Quid Pro Quo here on the Dead TV Podcast. And we leave you now with the music by Jess O'Lantern.